Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 6 months have passed and the Israeli genocide against Palestinians has not stopped in Gaza. However, as the regime continues its brutality, more and more people around the world are taking to the streets to protest against the Zionist entity. On Friday, International Quds Day, millions of people have participated in rallies and demonstrations across the world calling for an end to the regime's Holocaust and an end to the occupation. Is the Israeli regime looking at a different reality as it continues to lose the narrative against world opinion? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Jamal Joaquin, Professor of International Relations, Lebanese University out of Beirut. And Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. Welcome, both of you, to the program. I'd like to start it off in Beirut. Jamal, Imam Khomeini proclaimed International Quds Day to protest against the Zionist regime on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan 45 years ago. Your thoughts on the importance and the effects of that move?
I believe that that move was very important as a day to world, not only the Muslim world, but also the whole world, behind the Palestinian cause in support of the claims of the Palestinian people for their national rights and for their dignity. So this is how important, because this day has become a landmark in the history of the Palestinian people and the history of all the people who support the Palestinian cause.
Well, Peter, in 1979, when Imam Khomeini was exposing the Israeli regime, many people, especially in the West, could not understand what he was saying when he talked about the entity being a cancer which could spread if not stop. And today, not only in West Asia, but around the world, many people are saying the same as he said. And I want to talk about this transition and the importance of that, this growing awareness that is taking place, especially in the West.
It's happening from the ground up, from the popular level up to the elites. We've seen this particularly in just in the last few days after the murders of the seven Western aid workers. Now even the elites are taking notice and having been indifferent to the murders of about 200 Palestinian aid workers. Now that a handful of Westerners have been murdered, they're becoming, the elites, more responsive to popular opinion as expressed in the many, many marches which have taken place in Britain and other Western countries just 8 days ago in London. Over 200,000 people marched, and these marches have been regular occurrences over 7 months. The people are not losing their level of anger, indignation not only against Israel, but against their own government and against the elites. Now the elites, particularly after the murder of some of our own, I believe there were three British killed, even the elites now have changed their tone, and it's now becoming possible to talk about applying an arms embargo to Israel.
Well, let me just pick up right there with you, stay with you, Peter, for a minute, because you talked about the aid workers and the situation, and now, as you said, even the elite are paying attention. I mean, what does that mean, on the other hand? We're talking about over 32, 33,000 people, Palestinians being killed. And the attention that they showed was very different compared to what has happened since these seven individuals, these Westerners, have been killed. I mean, is this not mind-boggling in itself? I mean, your take on this.
Yes, it's outrageous in itself that the Western elites have been so indifferent to Palestinian suffering. And this is partly because that across the Western world, the elites, governments, and opposition parties have been complicit in the indifference. They have tried to ignore popular pressure. They never participate in the marches. But now, with the passage of time, with the accumulation of Israeli atrocities, murders, even the elites are having to change their tune. To some degree, there is still a hard right, which is very pro-Israeli and which continues to make excuses for Israel.
Right. Well, Jamal, since October 7th, there have been many protests that we've been talking about, supporting the Palestinians and standing against genocide. Your overall assessment of the effects of these protests, because from the very beginning there have been protests and they are growing. How effective at the end of the day do you think they are?
Well, too bad. I don't think that they are effective as long as they don't impact the decision process in the West, mainly in the West, and especially in the United States. Because we know that based on previous experiences, for example, this widespread demonstration against the involvement of the Western countries in wars or their support to Israel's wars was never hindered by these protests, as long as they are not channeled through lobbies, through pressure groups that could have an impact on the political decision makers. And too bad, the anti-Zionist and anti-establishment forces and parties in the West are very weak. Of course, in the rest of the world, too bad that popular stance is even weaker despite the feelings of sympathy towards the Palestinian people. So that's why I don't believe that these demonstrations would hinder or would affect much the support of Western governments to Israel.
Well, Peter, I mean, there is a growing gap between the people of the world and their governments regarding the Palestinian issue. Do you think that increasingly people are awakening to their own government's complicity regarding their crimes against Palestinians? And how do you think that this will play itself out in the long run?
Yes, particularly just in the last several days with the murders of the three British aid workers, possibly by the Israelis using British weapons. Suddenly, this is a new dimension of the conflict for British public opinion to digest. And this is causing problems for the government. The British government now appears to be divided about whether to impose an arms embargo on Israel. It's the direct involvement of our own nationals has changed to some extent the terms of the debate. But I agree that over the months, the many very large demonstrations have not had much, if any, visible impact on the behavior of our governments. But we're approaching election season, especially in America, where I think that the Democrats do feel pressure from the street. less so perhaps in Europe, but in America one sees even prominent Democrat politicians, Democrat Party politicians like Nancy Pelosi now coming out in favor of an arms embargo. Something has happened.
Right, yeah, indeed. Well, Jamal, do you think we are transitioning to a world which is more aware of the overall reality about the Israeli regime and also what the Palestinian people have endured for 75 years? And how might this all manifest itself?
Well, I believe that the world has always been aware of the situation in which the Palestinian people live. However, it was always the bias of this world, especially Western governments towards Israel, that hindered any possibility to give the Palestinians their rights.
Well, let me just jump in here. I mean, being an American myself, the reality is that so many Westerners really did not know the reality of the Palestinian situation. I know it's quite unbelievable, and we have seen since October 7th, so many people are saying we had no idea because of the mainstream media and how it has controlled the narrative all these years. And I know it's very difficult for a lot of people, especially on this side of the world, to even fathom, but the reality is that the majority of them, or so many of them, really did not know the reality of the situation between Palestine and the Israeli regime. Israel has been propped up as this democratic state, the only democratic state in the area, and of course the military, the most moral in the world, and that's what American kids and British kids have been taught. And now we're seeing a different reality. Go ahead.
Well, I'm sorry to say that, but I don't think so. When a time in the mid-70s, when Zionism was declared similar to Nazism as a Zionist, as a racist movement, and this ended actually in the 1990s. So the thing is that this is something that goes much beyond misinformation. It goes much further, and we need to understand the integral relationship that binds Israel and Zionist ideology to that of the establishment in the United States, especially when we talk about Christian Zionism. So I don't think that it's a matter of misinformation, but I think that things are changing, not because the Western governments are changing, but mainly because the Western powers are losing their edge in global affairs to the favor of rising powers such as Russia, China, Iran, South Africa, and other powers. So the world is shifting from an international order under Western and mainly US hegemony into a multipolar world. And I think that this would give the opportunity for the Palestinian people to benefit from this margin of contradiction between these superpowers in order to promote their own rights. And but I don't think that it's a matter of misinformation that made the Western public opinion and Western governments feel, more lenient towards supporting Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, definitely not Western governments. I mean, Peter, your thoughts, because I saw that you wanted to say something on that. Go ahead.
Well, we have to take into account that much of the media in Europe, certainly in Britain, is controlled by the Friends of Israel. And the newspaper which is most read in this country, the Daily Mail, is rabidly, crazily pro-Israeli. Just today, they published an article by the former foreign minister, Boris Johnson, saying that Hamas had to be defeated because Israel was defending Western civilization. Those are the very racist terms of the debate conducted in the British media. So there is also naked corruption and self-interest involved here. The Israeli lobby pay very well, and they're working in fertile ground, the grounds of white racism.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's an interesting thought when it talks about basically an extension or protecting Western civilization. Then that would be questionable. Then what is Western civilization if the Israeli regime is a symbol of it? That's a pity indeed. Well, Jamal, I mean, we've reached the end of the month of Ramadan, and before it started, there were talks about a ceasefire at least for this month, but it never happened. Do you think that we'll be seeing a ceasefire anytime soon?
Well, I don't think that we might see a ceasefire soon, as long as the United States supports Israel in its attempt to reach a sort of victory against the Palestinian resistance movement, which is very hard to by the Israelis. And that's why they are reverting to targeting civilians and killing tens of thousands of them, not to forget about the tens of thousands of injured Palestinians. So as far as we have the support by the U.S., I think that we might not reach a deal. But it seems that there are some signs that the Israelis are backing down on some of their conditions to reach a lasting truce with the Palestinians. We need to wait and see where these indirect negotiations going on in Qatar and sponsored by Qatar and Egypt on behalf of the Israelis would go.
Peter, UN Humanitarian Chief Martin Griffiths calls what Israel is doing in Gaza a betrayal of humanity. What does that mean, and what is supposed to happen now with that statement coming from this UN Humanitarian Chief?
Well, we may not have yet seen the worst, unfortunately. I believe the Israeli plan may be to allow food now to go back into the north of Gaza and then try to push the Palestinians penned at the moment up in Rafah to they will try, as they have stated they want to do, to empty Rafah so that the Israelis can then perform the atrocities that they want to in that remaining area of Gaza. And Palestinians would then be herded like sheep, like cattle, into northern Gaza. And this operation could take still several months. That is the worst scenario. And if there's one lesson we've learned over the 7 months, it is to, unfortunately, expect the worst.
Yes, indeed. Well, Jamal, in your perspective, Is there anything besides resistance that can bring this genocide and all the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people to an end?
Well, too bad, based on my personal experience living in Lebanon and witnessing all these atrocities and aggressions by Israel against the Palestinian people, the Lebanese people, and other Arab peoples, I don't think that there is an alternative way but to take up arms and fight against Israel. The Arabs counted on peace negotiations during the 1990s. It reached nowhere with Israel except for sacrificing more and more Arab rights. And I believe that the struggle with Israel will last for decades to come. There is no compromise in this regard. And of course, we will see more and more suffering by the Palestinian people and by the Arab people in general.
And Peter, your thoughts, the same question. Is there another way out, a political way, diplomatic way? Is there any other way out except for resistance at this point in time?
Frankly, no. I have to be honest. As a diplomat, I instinctively would like to think that there was a political way out, but experience of more than two decades of pursuing the illusion of the Middle East peace process teaches us that Israel will never make any meaningful concessions, and that therefore it is virtually inevitable that Israel will create conditions for the continuation of armed resistance. They leave no other option open to the Palestinians. But when the dust settles over Gaza, I think the situation will, the day after, will look like the day before, that we will be left with a Hamas government in Gaza, a lot of destruction, but the United Nations and others will step in to rebuild Gaza, and things will go on much as before.
Well, let's hope for the total freedom of Palestine, Palestinians all over that land. Thank you both for being with me on the Spotlight. Jamal Joachim, Professor of International Relations, Lebanese University, Beirut. Peter Ford, former British Ambassador to Syria, out of Manchester. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and other group right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson continue our Ramadan lifestyle post Eid. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are talking about continuing our Islamic lifestyle, or rather continuing our Ramadan lifestyle into our Islamic lifestyle post-Eid. So of course, you know, the day of Eid is this wonderful day in which we celebrate, you know, that inshallah we have hope that Allah has accepted this worship and fasting and the du'as and supplications and prayers and all the things that we did in the holy month of Ramadan. You know, we have a little bit of sadness because we have lost this divine companion, and many people will feel a little bit of sadness. One of the scholars, they have called it the post-Ramadan blues, and that's because you have this spiritual ecstasy that you are experiencing in this holy month, and when it ends, you kind of feel that dip, And many times, you know, we stop doing all of the things that we were doing in the holy month of Ramadan. So I'm not saying, you know, that we continue fasting throughout the rest of the year, every single day. But, you know, many of the supplications and the du'as that we were reciting in the holy month of Ramadan, the recitation of the Holy Quran, the focus and attention upon our prayers or praying, our salah, our wajib, obligatory daily prayers on time, or praying them, you know, but on time. All of these things should be continued, you know, now that the day of Eid is has passed, and of course the holy month of Ramadan has passed, right? For 30 days, we were able to live a Ramadan lifestyle. And so now, post Ramadan, we need to continue that lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about how we need to continue the Ramadan lifestyle into our regular Islamic lifestyle post Eid. So, you know, please be careful. Hopefully on the day of Eid you didn't break the rules, or you won't break the rules. Be careful about that, you know. Be careful about the mahram and non-mahram relationships and conditions. You know, don't break those as well. It's unfortunate that in the holy month of Ramadan, you know, we are focusing on spirituality and taqwa, you know, this God consciousness, this piety. But unfortunately, when we get to the day of Eid or after Eid, we kind of break all of these rules, and that's really detrimental to all of the spirituality and purity that we were gaining in the holy month of Ramadan. And so post Ramadan, you know, take some notes down, take some time out and write all of the various things that you learned in the holy month of Ramadan, and then inculcate them and keep them. I mean, you've already kept them for 30, 29 or 30 days and nights. You know, now you are kind of adjusted to this Ramadan lifestyle, which in reality we said was an Islamic lifestyle. And so continue that Islamic lifestyle for the rest of your life, inshallah. And if, God forbid, we start to become a little bit weak as we get closer to next year's holy month of Ramadan, well, we look forward to that holy month of Ramadan in order to once again recharge us and keep us on our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi,
Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied any involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident.
Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kyiv, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children, and there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate healthcare and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance, as well as the Western-led sanctions, are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
A lot of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands came together for the annual International Quds Day March in the Canadian city of Toronto to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian solidarity organizations and communities rallied across from the U.S. consulate, calling on Ottawa and Washington to act urgently to end the Israeli terror campaign and genocide and try to save as many lives as possible.
And this year it's especially important because people are motivated to come out in large numbers to bring an end to this genocide that's taking place in Gaza and underline their commitment to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea and a free Al-Quds, a free Jerusalem, free from Zionism and occupation.
Millions around the world are marching yesterday, today, and tomorrow, all week. Thousands of cities and towns across the globe are making Al-Quds Day an international day, a call for justice and freedom, particularly for the Palestinian people as they are facing genocide and war crimes in Gaza.
The city has continued its heavy policing of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Just 1 week ago, several participants were injured and six others were arrested in the annual Land Day commemoration by the Toronto police, who were captured on camera using excessive force.
So last week, people must have seen the videos by now, but the police completely attacked a peaceful rally, and there was horses involved, and this is what the police do. They're on the side of the Zionists, they terrorize people. You know, a protest, a simple, peaceful protest, you're not allowed. I mean, this is another example of the Palestine exception. That protest is good, it's a liberal, you know, it's a sign of democracy, except when you're talking about Palestine. You can't do that.
Participants also use Quds Day to condemn a recent deadly attack by the Israeli regime on Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital, Damascus.
Well, Iran has been subjugated to all forms of aggression at the hands of the Zionist regimes and their backers. But the last crime that Israel have done in destroying the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that is a zero tolerance. Iran will respond, and I think that Iran is being called upon by the people to respond against this Israeli aggression.
As the targeted killing of civilians and the starvation campaign continue, a temporary resident visa program announced by the administration in Ottawa 3 months ago has failed to bring to Canada any Palestinian relatives of Canadians from Gaza. Against that backdrop, families and activists are pressuring for a real arms embargo on Israel. Camila Escalante, Toronto.
Thousands of Austrians marched under the slogan "Stop the genocide, stop the occupation" in the capital Vienna. The Palestine Committee and Palestine Solidarity Austria organized the demonstration. The march was held on Saturday, a week after house raids of Palestinian activists in the city of Linz. Police recently also interrogated protesters in other cities. International Kurds Day was an aspiration for the organizers of Saturday's protest.
And all these commemoration days is to really say, wake up, we are really in the situation where people are getting killed every day and we have to stop it as soon as possible.
Organizers also criticized a four-day visit of the President of the Austrian Parliament, Wolfgang Sobotka, to Israel this week.
Well, obviously, when looking at the last 6 months, there's been some unconditional support for Israel, obviously, and their action in the Gaza Strip, which is absolutely unacceptable.
Several speakers stressed Austrian solidarity with Palestinians in war-torn Gaza as the US-Israeli genocidal war continues unabated. They said the Austrian government does not speak for them.
It's the most obvious wrongdoing that I've ever seen in my life.
The protesters called for support for Lebanon and Yemen against US imperialist aggression. People from around the world joined the Vienna march.
I was born in Chile under a dictatorship and I have a lot of Palestinian friends. I am even wearing a t-shirt from a team called Palestina who was founded by Palestinian migrants several years ago. I couldn't be in peace with myself if I wasn't here demonstrating and saying and raising my voice at least.
Representatives of Jewish organizations such as Not In Our Name stressed their continued solidarity with the Palestinian struggles. Organizers said all Austrians must continue to protest against the US-Israeli genocide and their government support for it, despite the repression.
We cannot call ourselves humans, regardless of our nationalities or political views or religions, and be indifferent about what's going on nowadays in Gaza.
Thousands marched in the Austrian capital Vienna in support of the people and the resistance in Gaza as the Israeli genocide war claims more civilian lives. Despite Austria's repression, the state and the police were unable to stop the Palestine solidarity movement. Saturday's demonstration has once again shown that the support for Gaza remains strong in Austria. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
With a military parade, Hezbollah marked International Quds Day in Lebanon, where hundreds of Lebanese and Palestinians raised their fists in a show of support for the resistance group and its leader. Hezbollah Secretary General underscored the significance of the Lebanese front and raised his voice in response to the Israeli threat, saying the resistance in Lebanon is fully prepared for any war.
The resistance in Lebanon does not fear war. It has managed battle in the last 6 months with a clear strategy and a vision which is complementary to the ongoing battle in the region. The resistance has managed the battle in a manner that would lead to victory while protecting Lebanon. However, it is fully prepared morally, mentally, and militarily for any war which the enemy would regret having launched against Lebanon.
Hezbollah's leader downplayed the ability of the Israeli regime to launch a full-scale war on Lebanon with the fact that it is extremely exhausted and has achieved none of its declared objectives except for the killing of innocent women and children. And despite the sacrifices, he said, the alliance of resistance is on the path to a historic and major victory.
Based on logic and political, military, diplomatic, regional, international and economic information, we are able to see very clearly what the leader of the Iranian revolution had said during the first days of the war, that Israel will be defeated and that Gaza will be victorious, and Netanyahu will have no choice but to stop the war, which will be a historic and major victory for the resistance in the region.
A significant part of the speech touched upon the Iranian role in supporting the resistance factions and the oppressed people of the region. It also confirmed that the Iranian response to the Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus will certainly come, and that everyone needs to be ready for what may lie ahead after this retaliation.
We are very close to a victory since the blood that has been shed in Gaza and Lebanon and from all our brothers will be fruitful. This is why this year is exceptional and it has a very positive impact on our hearts and has given us hope that a big victory is possible.
It's not just the duty of Muslims to take part in Al-Quds Day,
but also as human beings all over the world, since it proves their humanity.
We are here not to support just Gaza, we are supporting all Palestine, the resistance in all region. We'll elaborate Palestine and Al-Quds, and we will win, inshallah.
Hezbollah's leader also noted that Al-Aqsa flood has put Israel's existence in danger and exposed its vulnerabilities. And those who should be ashamed are the ones who have normalized ties with Israel.
Al-Quds Day this year is distinct on all levels. Loud actions have been made, not only in support of the Palestinian people, but in establishing what could turn into a tangible plan to end the occupation of the Holy Land. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In the limelight.
The all-encompassing Red Sea blockade enacted by Yemen has redefined the geopolitical dynamics. The act of resistance, prompted by Israel's genocide against the people of Gaza, has shaken the Tel Aviv regime's market while dealing a serious blow to the fallacy of American and Israeli invincibility. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "It was not long ago when Washington, with its fleet of advanced battleships and aircraft, ensured that its Israeli partners could enjoy free sailing and unfettered access to the world market via the Bab al-Mandab Strait. Now that sense of security is gone forever. In November, Yemen, led by the Ansarullah movement, began targeting ships linked to the US and Israel with an arsenal of advanced homegrown missiles and drones. Yemen asserted that these operations will stop the moment the aggression on Gaza stops and aid is allowed in, which is fulfilling its international duty to prevent the crime of genocide under UN law. The US responded by creating a maritime alliance of dwindling powers and unseasoned militaries to stop the Yemeni military, dubbing the unimpressive operation Prosperity Guardian. Prosperity Guardian fell apart before the first ship sailed. Spain, Italy, France, and Australia rejected specific requests for personnel and warships. Even more pathetically, Estonia decided to send a record-setting one person to assist the U.S. embarrassing task force. The U.S. and the U.K. were left alone to take the lead and carry out aggression on Yemen in retaliation for the blockade imposed on their key ally, the regime in Tel Aviv that lacks legitimacy. The aggression launched jointly by the U.S. and the U.K., coupled with some treacherous Arab regime, assistance from Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Bahrain began early on January 12th. Now, less than 4 months into defending international commerce, the US is backpedaling. It was evident last week when US envoy to Yemen, Tim Lenderking, made this very revealing remark to Reuters. "We favor a diplomatic solution. We know that there is no military solution." Indeed, the United States military solution has failed. Despite bombings of civilian infrastructure and the killing of several Yemeni military personnel, Yemen has been able to effectively continue its blockade throughout the US-led aggression. Not only are Zionist-linked ships targeted with appropriate missiles and drones to prevent access to Bab al-Mandab Strait,
but Yemen has made direct hits against U.S. warships as well. U.S. officials are also floating the idea of removing Ansarullah from the State Department's designated list of terrorist groups, as the State Department hopes to use its power over sanctions and the global trade norms to entice Yemen into allowing the return of Zionist commerce. This is a bloody nose to the image of the United States, whose military bases clutter the region with false promises of security for host countries. The United States has lost global support, barely able to pull together a task force of interested countries. Now, it cannot even stop a war-torn country by itself, despite engaging in criminal targeting of civilian infrastructure and ports used to bring in food and aid. The myth of U.S. naval supremacy has been shattered. Furthermore, Yemen's extraordinary bravery is seen, acknowledged, and admired by millions of people around the world who oppose U.S. hegemony. U.S. officials issued a series of warmongering statements leading into Operation Prosperity Guardian, but Yemen has humbled it and proved yet again that the U.S. is nothing but a paper tiger. Yemen survived nearly a decade of U.S.-backed Saudi aggression, which forced conditions such as an acute starvation and disease in many parts of the poorest Arab country. The U.S. State Department removed Ansarullah as a designated terror group in 2021, but retained the label this year as they sought to stop the Yemeni blockade. Yemen has already survived this designation and aggression, and now it is taking it on again in solidarity with the Palestinian cause. Simultaneously, the U.S. is now in a critical spot. The admission that Yemen cannot be stopped militarily begs the question, what can be done to return trade to normal? The impacted route has blocked Israel's third busiest port, the port of Eilat, from conducting any trade. The port has been effectively shut down, with half of its employees being laid off. Eilat has also come under attack, both from Yemeni drones and rockets, as well as ones from the Iraqi resistance. Since the start of the Red Sea blockade, the port has seen an 85% drop in its activity. Shortly after the U.S. plea for diplomacy, Yemeni spokesman Mohammed Ali al-Houthi announced that Yemen is far from done with its resistance operations. He remarked, "From the coast of the Red Sea or from outside it, we can achieve the goals we want in defense of our country and support of Palestine. We still have many military surprises, and there are military operations that we are keeping secret as part of a specific media strategy. The missiles that have been used against U.S.-Israeli vessels, including warships, are advanced, but they are far from Yemen's best. In military parades held throughout the years, and even in some of the weekly Friday rallies in support of Palestine, Yemen has displayed some of its powerful weaponry. Just last month, Ansarullah announced the successful test of a hypersonic missile, something the U.S. does not even have despite much hyped and much advertised military prowess." Yemen's fierce resistance to U.S. threats has top U.S. admirals reassessing their own capabilities. In their own admission, the U.S. has not fought a naval battle of this caliber since the Second World War. The United States must now risk embarrassing itself further and strengthening the image of the Axis of Resistance, or reel in its Zionist partner in crime. Meanwhile, global support for Yemen is surging as the heroic fighters tighten the blockade against U.S. and Israeli-linked ships. Yemen is not interested in diplomacy with genocidal regimes. As Ansarullah leaders have stated time and again, All that needs to happen for the resistance operations to stop is the withdrawal of Zionist regime troops from Gaza, a lasting ceasefire, and the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza. These demands are clear and firm. Yemen will only double down on its resistance, not falter.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies,